And good morning to everyone. Our first case of the day is State v. Joshua E. Belk. Mr. Nyman, good morning to you.
Good morning,
you may approach.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. My name is Bill Nyman, and I'm here representing Mr. Belk on his appeal from the District Court of Platte County, Nebraska, which denied his motion for post-conviction relief. It's basically a two-pronged appeal, I think, that we have here. First is his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at the time he entered his no-contest pleas, and then the other is whether his pleas to the charges represented knowingly, intelligent, and voluntary pleas. In this case, when you review the record, his trial attorney, Mr. Zarayakov, had a seven-minute conversation with Mr. Belk about what the plea offer was in this case. Mr. Zarayakov indicated at the time of the hearing on the motion for post-conviction relief that he had relayed these plea offers to the defendant at some point prior to the defendant coming over to the courthouse. The defendant, on the other hand, indicated at that hearing that the first time he heard about these pleas was when he showed up at the courthouse on the morning he entered the pleas.
Did the district court make a factual finding as to who it believed?
The district court, if you read the district's court order, the only way it could have found the way it found was to totally disregard Mr. Belk's testimony and to completely believe Mr. Zarayakov's testimony regarding that issue.
And what's our standard of review of factual issues at this point?
It would be clear error, Your Honor.
And so you're arguing that it's clear error?
Well, I am, Your Honor, and I think if you look, it's contained in Exhibit 9. If you look at that transcript, it's unusual to see these. In fact, it's the first time I've ever seen one in a criminal case where a defense counsel actually has the court reporter transcribe his conversation with the defendant. And if you look at that, to me it was pretty clear, at least, that the defendant didn't know anything about this plea offer before that transcribed conversation. He's asking a lot of questions in there about the plea and whether he wants to take it and he really doesn't want to take it and those types of issues. He does not appear, at least not to me, that he knew anything about this prior to coming to the courthouse that day, which would be consistent with what he testified to at the hearing on the motion for post-conviction relief.
Isn't it equally consistent with someone who's just uncertain about what they want to do?
It could be, Your Honor. We also have some emails that are in evidence between the prosecutor and the defense attorney. And one of those last emails, which I'm not sure if it's one of the last ones, but it's close to the last, the prosecutor or the defense attorney indicates to the county attorney that he is pretty sure that Mr. Belk is not going to accept the offer and Mr. Belk is going to insist on going to trial. And then we come up to the date, I think it was February 27th, 2015, I guess, this time. And that's when we had this seven-minute conversation between Mr. Belk and his attorney. At the end of that conversation, there's a three-minute window in there, and then the district judge comes in and calls the case. So after that conversation with his attorney, if the court were to find that is clear error, he has about 3 minutes to think about this plea offer before he's called on to come in to testify or to accept the plea offer. And if you look at the Exhibit 2, which is the transcript of the plea hearing, when asked by the judge if the plea agreement is recited into the record by Mr. Zarayakov, and then when he's asked by the judge if that's the agreement as he understands it to be, he replies to the judge, "That's what I was told." And then the judge goes through, "Do you know of any other possible defenses you might have to this charge? I haven't fully discussed with your attorney, Mr. Zarayakov." And at that point, the defendant replies, "Well, we argued about it."
Did the plea agreement change from the 21st to the 27th?
No, it did not change between the 21st and the 27th.
So Mr. Zarayakov didn't think he'd take the deal on the 21st, so evidently there was some discussion about it with the appellant on this on that plea agreement on the 21st, is that correct?
Mr. Zarayakov indicated that he had discussed it with the appellant between the time he received it on the 21st and the time he went into court on the 27th.
Wasn't the email to the prosecutor on the 21st?
I believe that's the correct date. And on that, that's the email where he indicates he does not believe the defendant is going to accept the plea offer.
So the defendant knew about it on at least the 21st of February.
That I'm not certain if the record supports. I don't believe Mr. Zarayakov in the email indicates that he's actually talked to the defendant. He indicates, I'll present it to the defendant. I'm not optimistic. I believe he's going to want to go to trial. And again, the defendant says that his testimony was that he did not know anything about this proposed plea offer before he came into court on the 27th and entered his no contest plea.
Did your client receive a benefit from the plea agreement?
He did, Your Honor. With the charges he was facing, he would have had a mandatory minimum 25-year sentence because it was alleged sexual assault, child under 14, himself being over 19. And what he eventually pled to was a Class II felony punishable by, I believe, a minimum of 1, maximum 50 years. So he did receive a benefit.
No, it's hard to say. The sentence doesn't seem to give him much benefit. He got 30 to 45, didn't he?
But in any event, it was what he pled to.
Or 30 to 40 was his sentence, wasn't it?
I thought it was 25 to 30, and then he got 5 to 10 for account 3, which was incest. All of the sentences were ordered to run concurrently.
Yeah, okay. 30 to 40.
In any event, we believe that this shows the ineffectiveness of counsel if the court is to find that that three-minute window is a very short period of time to consider a plea that essentially could put you in prison for the rest of your life. I know that a lot of people spend more time than that deciding what to order off of a menu going to a restaurant. And again, it's a question of law and fact, factual findings of clear error, and then counsel's performance is a question that the court has to decide. And again, I think it's important that the court looks at that. Why? And I asked the question, why did you have this conversation transcribed with your client prior to your entering these pleas? And the reason I asked that is I've never done that, and I've never actually seen that done before. So it just surprised me that somebody would do that.
What effect does the court's advisement have at the time of the plea?
He would have asked the defendant if he was satisfied with his attorneys, or he had actually a public defender and the Commission of Public Advocacy, and he would have asked if he was satisfied with the services they had rendered. At that point, I believe the defendant said, not really, but he said he would go along. The judge would have asked him, had Mr. Zarayakov recite the plea agreement into the record, and then he asked Mr. Bell if that was the plea agreement as he understands it, which he replied, that's what I was told. And then he would have asked him, have you discussed with your attorney any and all offenses you believe you have to these charges? Are there any defenses you believe you have in this case which you have not discussed with your attorney? And that's where he replies, we argued about it. In any event, it would be Mr. Belk's position that pleas were not knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently entered, that he had insufficient time to consider those pleas. And then the other thing I would ask the court to look at is under Mr. Belk's testimony, he states when he was taken back to jail, he was still on suicide watch, so he's put in, it's basically a solitary confinement area they have in the front part of the jail where somebody can be watched all the time, and they're put in a suicide suit. They're not able to make phone calls or do anything from that point. He states that the first thing he did when he got out of there and was able to make a phone call was called back to the public defender's office. He talked to Mr. Mathis, which would be the public defender, that would be Mr. Zarayakov's boss, and told Mr. Mathis, I want those pleas withdrawn, I want to go to trial. And at that point, Mr. Mathis filed two motions. He filed a motion to withdraw his pleas, and he filed a motion to withdraw as counsel for the defendant. The motion to withdraw as counsel for the defendant was granted. Mr. James Stecker, now Judge Stecker, was appointed to represent him at that point. Mr. Stecker did do the hearing on his motion withdrawal of pleas. The trial court denied that. That was appealed to the Court of Appeals. They did affirm that the district court's decision on that issue.
What's your best argument that it wasn't simply buyer's remorse?
Your Honor, it would kind of be the whole record in and of itself. The fact that Mr. Belt testifies he didn't know anything about these pleas, what he actually said at the time he entered the pleas.
So it comes down to your client's credibility.
His credibility and the record, I think, would support that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Ms. Duffy, good morning to you.
May it please the court, counsel, I'm Siobhan Duffy, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of Appalachia, the state of Nebraska. Appellant is asking this court to reverse the order of the district court denying his motion for post-conviction relief following an evidentiary hearing. The state believes the district court correctly denied appellant's position, and we would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Appellant's overarching claim is that he received ineffective assistance of trial counsel, and that can be further broken down into two areas. His allegations that trial counsel pressured him into accepting a plea, and his allegations that trial counsel failed to share discovery with him. Regarding the plea agreement, trial counsel at the evidentiary hearing testified that appellant instructed him to begin seeking plea offers, that he did so, and that he communicated an offer to the appellant. Trial counsel was informed by appellant that he would be accepting the plea offer, but on the morning of the plea hearing, appellant hesitated, and that's when trial counsel made that advisement, letting appellant know about the consequences of rejecting the plea. At the plea hearing, the appellant confirmed for the district court that he was acting freely and voluntarily, that the decision to accept the plea agreement was his to make, and that he had made the decision to accept the plea agreement. Trial counsel did not pressure appellant into accepting a plea, and his performance was not deficient. Turning to the discovery issues, appellant argues that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to share discovery with him. Trial counsel testified at the evidentiary hearing that his office's policy was to provide police reports and, if requested, deposition transcripts. Trial counsel had no specific memory of either providing or not providing those deposition transcripts, but he did testify that appellant was actually present at those depositions, so he was aware of the content. Further, notes in trial counsel's case file shows that police reports copies were made for the appellant. Trial counsel also testified he shared information he gained during witness interviews with the appellant, and he also recalled reviewing portions of appellant's videotaped confession with him. The evidence at the hearing showed that trial counsel did share discovery with the appellant, and his performance was not deficient in this regard. Those are the end of my prepared remarks.
What was the sentence given by the trial court? That's not disputed.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
35 to 40, isn't it?
Correct, 35 to 40. I will note that appellant's original charges were first-degree sexual assault of a child alleged as a second offense, so the actual sentence would have been 25 years mandatory minimum.
Well, he was charged as a Class 2 felony, right?
Correct. That
normally, sexual assault of a child is a Class 1B felony.
I don't recall
I don't know when the statute was amended, but subsequently, first offense of sexual assault of a child is a minimum of 15.
Correct. And that his initial charge was first-degree sexual assault of a child. An amended information was filed which alleged that those three charges of first-degree sexual assault of a child were second offenses based on previous convictions in Lancaster County. And then, pursuant to the plea agreement, a second amended information was filed which charged appellant with first-degree sexual assault.
Simply a Class 2 felony.
Correct, Your Honor.
Did each count carry the mandatory minimum of 25 then?
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
So he would have gotten at least 25 and possibly 75.
Correct, Your Honor. So there was a substantial agreement, or a substantial benefit from the plea agreement that appellant received.
Well, we don't really know that since he got 35 years minimum.
Correct, Your Honor, although with good time, if appellant earns it, he couldn't earn it on the 25 years.
Okay. Right. So what issues were really preserved for post-conviction?
Well,
an issue of whether he was pressured into the plea an issue that was preserved for post-conviction? Wasn't that litigated on direct appeal?
Well, Your Honor, on direct appeal, appellant assigned as error the denial of the district court of his motion to withdraw his plea. To the extent that appellant is simply arguing that his pleas were not knowingly and voluntarily made, that is barred because it could have been raised on direct appeal. Now, if he's arguing...
Was that encompassed in the direct appeal? But what was the meaning of, I want to withdraw the plea?
I think it could have been encompassed, Your Honor. I think he actually signed his error and argued that the district court denied his motion to withdraw his plea. I suppose it could have been encompassed, yes, Your Honor. I do think that the evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing shows that those pleas were entered knowingly and voluntarily. He confirmed that for the district court upon questioning, that it was his decision, that no threats or pressure or promises had been made to induce him to enter into the plea agreement.
So that particular factual question is probably resolved.
Correct, Your Honor. I think ultimately this does come down to a question of witness credibility, and the district court in its order specifically stated that the credible evidence presented at the evidentiary hearing, and I think that shows that he found trial counsel's testimony to be credible, and appellant is really asking this court to pass again on witness credibility.
What is he really saying is that but for counsel's ineffective performance, I would have not pled but insisted on going to trial? Is that the standard that we're looking at?
That is the standard to show deficient performance. I think that he has not shown that. I think he's shown that he did change his mind after entering into the plea agreement, but that does not mean that counsel performed efficiently in representing
him. And when was the transcript or the court reporting of the conference done?
It was done shortly, just I believe 10 to 15 minutes before the plea hearing. I think that the emails between trial counsel, between Mr. Sorykoff and Mr. Cordes on the Commission of Public Advocacy, show that appellant was aware before the plea agreement, well aware of the plea offer. In Exhibit 11 on page 26 on February 14th, Mr. Sorykoff emailed Mr. Cordes, said that he'd been told to begin seeking plea offers by appellant. On 221, that's pages 29 to 30 of Exhibit 11, Mr. Sorykoff emailed Cordes and said that he had relayed the new offer, but he wasn't hopeful. So I think we can affirmatively say, based on those emails, that by February 21st, appellant was aware of the plea agreement. So six days before.
What discovery did appellant claim he did not receive or was not privy to as far as the witnesses and that sort of thing?
He claimed, Your Honor, that trial counsel did not share with him police reports, which notes in trial counsel's case file show that copies were made for appellant. He alleged
copies were made or copies were sent to.
It officially, I believe, the notes said copies made for appellant. So I guess technically it doesn't show that they were given. Trial counsel testified that his office's policy is to automatically provide those police reports.
What was in the police reports?
I think it would have been, Your Honor, there was a disclosure made, so it would have been the investigators relaying of all the information leading up to appellant's arrest.
And did he make a statement to police?
He did, Your Honor. I believe at the time of the plea hearing, that statement had not been transcribed. It was videotaped, and trial counsel testified he did recall reviewing portions.
What did he say in that statement?
Your Honor, in the statement that he made, the investigator asked a lot of questions. Some of the disclosures, I suppose you could call them, the confession appellant made.
Did he admit to committing the crime?
Yes, Your Honor, he did. He admitted to...
And so he would know he had made his admission.
Correct, Your Honor. I think
and
there...
he would know what the witnesses were going to say that were deposed because he was present at their depositions.
Correct.
And the only evidence he would not know is what the mother and the victim would have testified to, but wasn't he advised by counsel as to what they were going to say and that they didn't want to take their depositions?
That is correct, Your Honor. Counsel did testify that he interviewed the victim and her mother, and then he relayed that information gleaned during that interview to the appellant. Unless there are additional questions, we request that this court affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. We will go on to the next case of the day, which is In Re Interest of Carmelo G. Mr. Nyman, were you appointed in this matter?